Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamish, who's an Israeli patriot who's really done some of the fundamental work on the murder of the Israeli Prime Minister Rabin. This was back in the 1990s, 1995, somewhere in there. And of course, he's managed through the years to convince the majority of the religious Jews in Israel that the Prime Minister was assassinated as part of a government's conspiracy. And, of course, what happens in Israel parallels what's happened in the United States. There's no question that John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed by elements within our own government. And if you doubt that, you need to get the 2-4 tape sets we have with people who are intimately involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. Or certainly they killed Bobby Kennedy. After all, there were 14 shots fired, and Saran's gun only had 8 bullets in it, and he was standing in front of Bobby Kennedy, whereas the bullets that killed Bobby Kennedy came from behind. And of course, the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King, you never heard about the trial. The media totally blocked it out because the jury actually decided that the government was 70% responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King, and then they had the audacity to make a national holiday for Martin Luther King, a man that had been killed by elements within the Central Intelligence Agency. These things go on. They're not imaginary. They're very real. And unless you understand that behind this there are powerful spiritual forces, nothing really makes sense. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about what's going on over in Israel. And this last week I came across an article where they announced they were going to give the gas masks back to the Israeli people. And what had happened, certainly after the last war, why the government came around and picked up all the gas masks, saying that they were going to refurbish them and get them ready to be used, and then they never returned them. Well, this article said they were going to give the gas masks back to the Israeli people. After all, there's a very real threat of a chemical or biological war coming very, very soon. And within 5 years, they'd be able to get them back in the hands of the Israeli people. Well, what good is that going to do you if we have an attack in 3 months or 6 months? 5 years from now, they're going to give the gas masks back. Why would they take them away? Are they trying to demoralize the Israeli people? Why is the United States training the Palestine terrorists? In fact, we have a general over in Jordan who's training components of the PLO army over there, arming them, preparing them for war. Do you think they're going to fight Hamas? Do you think they're going to fight the Israelis? The United States is selling sophisticated military equipment to Saudi Arabia. Why would we do that? Saudi Arabia, after all, remember 15 of the 19 original terrorists that attacked the United States had come from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the major financier of the world terrorist movement. That, along with Pakistan, who we're also financing. Saudi Arabia actually trains people in the Wahhabi radical religion that advocates jihad against America and Israel. So why would we be selling them sophisticated weapons, guided missiles, guided weapons? So many things going on don't make sense, do they, Barry?
Now, funny you should mention RFK. I had a letter communication with his attorney. He's dead now. He died, I guess, about a year ago. But it was uncanny that we had really the same documents. The same medical documents, the same ballistic documents. Well, they were twin murders. They were really done the same way. And who knows if that was a coincidence. Probably it wasn't. But I'm glad you brought that up.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Go right ahead.
Oh, well, I'm going to start with an interesting story that Jimmy Carter has inspired. Carter is in Israel right now, and most of the Israeli government won't meet with him because he is on his way, I guess, tonight to Damascus, where he's going to meet the head of Hamas, Khaled Mashal. Now, first of all, the Israelis who did meet with him is interesting as well. Shimon Peres, of course, he got into the peace business because of Carter. The whole 1979 Camp David Accord got Peres into the business of exploiting peace. So he's got something to say to Carter, and Ehud Barak, I suppose, has something to say to Carter. But Livni, Foreign Minister Livni, and Prime Minister Ehud Olmert point-blank refused to meet with him because he is meeting Mashal. But one person did meet Carter, and go and figure this out. Is Avigdor Lieberman, head of the, well, let's see, is he bigger than the Likud or slightly smaller? Nonetheless, he's got either the largest right-wing party or second-largest right-wing party in the Knesset, is meeting with Carter, and that makes no sense. I'm going to tell you outright, that makes no sense whatsoever. And if someone smarter than me can figure out why he's doing it, but it's not good for Israel, and it's not good for anybody that anyone is meeting with Carter, but Lieberman makes no sense whatsoever. Now, that's just the background to the real story. The real story is Khaled Mashal. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of history. Khaled Mashal, when Netanyahu was prime minister in 97 to 99, one of his objectives was to kill Khaled Mashal. And he got the Mossad to Jordan. He was in Jordan at the time. Now he's in Damascus. And the Mossad caught him. And they injected him with something that was killing him. He was in a comatose state, but the Mossad were caught. They were the Mossad hit team was caught in Jordan. This, I believe, was 1998.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Barry Sutton. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is just telling us a story about this gentleman that wasn't a gentleman. He was actually probably tied into a world terrorist movement, but suddenly he was an enemy of Israel. The Mossad had caught him and injected him with something that put him into a comatose state. What was the man's name, and what was his background?
Khaled Mashal. That's who Carter is meeting in Damascus.
Okay, fine. Okay.
He is really the head of Hamas. He has been for many, many years. He's not welcome in Israel, and certainly not welcome in Gaza. Israel would block that. But he's happily living in Damascus, where Carter is going to discuss peace with him. I mean, this guy's a butcher. But nonetheless, Netanyahu ordered the butcher killed, which, by the way, would have been a tremendously good thing to do.
Now, what year was that?
98.
98, okay.
Again, I invite people to go to the Google or Yahoo and write Khaled Mashal Mossad Netanyahu, and that should bring up the killing. Now, Jordan captured the Mossad killers, which means, by the way, that somebody exposed them. Now, that somebody was the man who lost the elections to Benjamin Netanyahu in 97, that would have been Shimon Peres. Who else had the power or the desire to humiliate Netanyahu? Now, there's something very, very important. The Jordanians captured the Mossad killers, but didn't publicly execute them. They weren't dragged through the street. Instead, a deal was cut. Jordan would return the killers. Let's not guess it. The Mossad agents, the hit squad. If antidote was shipped to Jordan to save Michelle's life. And that's exactly what was done. Within a day, the antidote made it to Jordan. It miraculously saved Michelle's life. Who knows what this poison was? That it would have an antidote is really a very strange poison, but that's what happened. And the Mossad hit team was returned to Israel. A very strange episode in Middle East diplomatic history. I'm going to add one little detail. My friend Adir Zeke, the broadcaster and journalist who died of throat cancer suddenly, heartbreaking for me. I mean, just heartbreaking. But what he told me is, if they could do that to Michelle, they could give me this cancer. It came out of nowhere the same way. Now, what I'm going to discuss is who exposed Netanyahu. The Mossad doesn't get caught. There was one incident in, Lillehammer, Norway, in the 70s, where they accidentally killed a Moroccan waiter instead of a PLO leader, and the squad was caught. But other than that, the Mossad doesn't get caught. And immediately, suspicion fell on Paris. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story about the 97 elections. These were the elections held after the Rabin assassination. And I had started making a very effective public stink about the Rabin murder already by 97. I had national television exposure, and the country was talking about the conspiracy. And it was really quite an accomplishment. I spoke at Hebrew University. The Shabak went crazy. That's the Secret Service. And I ended up being front page, every newspaper in Israel, first item on the news, the works, because they went and had a violent demonstration against me at Hebrew University. And the morning after that demonstration, I got a phone call from Mr. Yaakov Moore, very nice man, by the way, who told me on the phone that he used to work for the Shabak. He said, I won't hide it from you. I used to work for the Shabak. And he says to me, why did they do this to you at the university? He said, you must be holding on to a really hot potato for them to go to this much trouble. And I said, I guess I am. And he says, look, I'm now the financial advisor for Eli Yishai. Eli Yishai is in today's cabinet of the Shas party. We've gone over Shas and how they've been blackmailed and so forth in a previous show. But Eli Yishai back then, I thought maybe, wanted my information for a good reason, you know, to get rid of corruption in the government, to expose the truth. Whatever it was, Yaakov Moore asked himself over to my house, and I accepted. And he arrived the next day. And there, you know, we had a nice conversation. And back then I had a grand total of dozens of documents. I ended up with 2,500. But back then I had the medical documents, which were extremely revealing. And I also had the ballistics test from Israel police.
Now, this was all about, of course, Rabin's assassination, you're speaking of, right?
Oh, of course.
Right.
That's why he was there. Else would anyone visit me? Why would a Knesset cabinet minister's financial advisor visit me at home? He wanted to know what I had in Rabin and why there was this riot at Hebrew University, in short. And, by the way, this riot, don't underestimate it. It really dominated the news for a week. It was a huge Israeli event, of which I was at the center attraction. It was my speech that exploded the Rabin conspiracy. And I was still researching my book. It hadn't come out yet. But Yaakov Moore, I give to Yaakov Moore, a collection of documents, including the police ballistics report, from Chief Inspector Baruch Gladstein that said Rabin was shot at point-blank range. I compared it to the Shamgar report, said he was shot from 50 centimeters. I had the bullet hole, the bullet shattering Rabin's back, an impossibility, because I also have the Rabin film where he keeps on walking. And I showed it to Yakov, and Yakov takes the documents, and he's flipping through them. And after about 20 minutes, he turns to me, and he puts his index finger on his lips, and he stands up, and with his left hand, he guides me outside the house. And he says, you think, we get outside, we're in the street now. He says, you think I'm going to talk in your house? I said, sure, why not? He says, you don't think you're thoroughly bugged? You know those documents are authentic? And I said, sure, I know they're authentic. And he says to me, do you understand how high this has to go up? And I said, yeah, I've caught on that it goes very, very high. And he says, I'm going to report to my minister, that's Eli Yishai, once again, of Shas. And we're going to have a meeting with you. These are extremely important. And the next day I get a phone call from Eli Yishai's secretary. And she says to me that the minister would like to meet with you. When would you like to meet with him? And I said, anytime you want, I'll be there. And she said, bring your documents, and in exchange for them, we'll give you the most important issue of the Rabin assassination. I said, you will? She said, bigger than what you've got. She said, we're going to give you something of equal value. And I said, sure, sounds great. So I get picked up. Yakov Moore picks me up in his nice air-conditioned car, a little luxury for the day, and we go to Jerusalem. We go into the ministry, and I was told to go into a room, and I sit in the room, and I hear very energetic screaming from the hall. Not screaming so much as arguing. And finally, in comes the spokesman to this very day, Yitzhak Sudri of the Shas Party. He was a very young man then. He was 25 years old, maybe less. And he sits down and says to me, the minister couldn't meet with you, but he authorized me to tell you that every word I say comes from him. I said, okay, I'll live with that. I had no choice. Sudri denies this, by the way. All of Shas denies any truth in their past. But nonetheless, he says, we'd like your documents. We'd like to photocopy them. In exchange, I'll give you proof that the 97 elections were rigged. We rigged the... He said, they were rigged. The Netanyahu lost the elections. Peres won the elections. They were rigged. And I said, well, I said, that sounds good to me. So I gave him the documents, and they photocopied them. And he told me the story. He said that the Likud party discovered what I discovered, but more. He said there's lots more. And he was right, by the way. I thought I had, well, the bad guys by their privates, but he said there's much, much more. And ultimately, I discovered that there was very much more. There were cartridge tests. Yigal Amir's hands had no gunpowder on them, so on and so forth.
He was the supposed assassin to get the mirror. Go ahead.
Yeah, the patsy. Now, what he says to me is that there was a meeting in February. The elections were in May of 1997. And he said, oh, I'll continue after the commercial.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with Barry Shamus. Ladies and gentlemen, they kill governmental leaders indiscriminately in Israel and in the United States. Go right ahead with the story.
All right, so there was a meeting in 1997 February of 97, just before the elections in May. And what what Yitzhak Suri told me is that the Likud had the goods on Peres for killing Rabin. It's that simple. And he said they offered an ultimatum. They took out some of the documents, and they said if you mention the name Yitzhak Rabin once in the upcoming campaign, we're going to release these to the public. God knows what they were. He took his hand and, like he was playing cards, he was releasing the documents. And then he says, there's going to be a televised debate. If Peres doesn't lose, we'll release these to the public. And finally, they came up with a big one. He says, if Peres wins these elections, we're going to release them all to the public. Labor was blackmailed because Peres murdered Rabin, and Likud found it out. And Netanyahu, instead of being honest with the public, I mean, who can believe that he used it for blackmail? He blackmailed Peres. He thought that was better than letting the Israeli public know that a murderer was running as Prime Minister of Israel. He let that go on, knowing that he was going to win the elections. Now, what Sudri told me is, I'm going to give you the name and phone number of a PhD student in Tel Aviv. He's been researching this issue, and this is how we found out. And he'll tell you what he'll tell you. I went to Tel Aviv a day later, 2 days later, who can remember, but it was very shortly after. And I met with a student, a very bright and very scared young man. Very scared. We met, as usual, by the way, every lousy restaurant in Israel is where people wanted to meet me. They wanted a quiet place that nobody hangs around in. If you want to know where the lousy restaurants of Israel are, I'm the expert. We met at one. We were the only people that really... in a corner table, and he said, he gave me the whole story of Likud got the documents, and I've got copies of them, and I'll try and get them to you tomorrow. I'll give you the story of how Likud blackmailed the Labor Party, but he said outright, he said, all the polls were right. Peres won by 2%. That's what the polls said, and that's exactly what happened. And now, without, he was a very nice guy, but he was talking in a whisper, and when my voice raised a little higher than he liked, he would take his hand and tell me to, he would pump it down for me to whisper. Very, very scared person. The next day, he phoned me up and said, I can't talk to you anymore, I got a phone call this morning. And that was it. He said, I got a phone call, someone talked to me, I can't talk to you anymore. And that was the end of my letter from Tel Aviv. Nonetheless, I mentioned him in my books and the conversation we had, but I had to find further proof of this. And I did, by the way. And we'll slowly get to that. But I'm going to remind...
All right, those, I want you to sort of hold those thoughts for just a moment as we bring our other stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Chris Berry. Comments that the this assistant to the head of this political party had met him there at the political party headquarters and told him that there was no question at all that actually Netanyahu had not won the election in certainly in 1997, that it had been rigged. But, of course, Peres, of course, who won the election, was responsible for the murder of Rabin, and they just said, you know, you're not going to win this election, and if you certainly win the election and then or contest the fixed election, why, we're going to release all the information. Perry talks about going to a student in Tel Aviv who had all of the details, frightened for his life when he suddenly realized the implications of the fact that the president, the prime minister of Israel, had been assassinated, Rabin had been assassinated, and of course the government agencies that had killed him had gotten away with it, and he wondered if he could be less after he talked to Barry. Why, the very next morning he called Barry and said, I can't ever talk to you again. I've had a telephone call. I cannot, of course, talk to you anymore. So at that time, Barry is still trying to get the information about the rigging of the election in 1997 that brought Netanyahu to power. And even though Peres, the murderer, had actually certainly won the election, why he did not contest the election, after all, the last thing he wanted was the people of Israel to realize that he had killed his political adversary. Go right ahead.
Oh, he contested the election. He was running for prime minister, but he was running a losing campaign, because he couldn't win. Look, how to rig an election is, probably a subject, worthy of 15 minutes, how the polls work and so forth. You can rig an election if you take the votes and you destroy them, and you replace votes for Peres with spoiled votes or votes that suddenly became for Netanyahu. That's what they did, and I'll explain that very, very shortly. But first of all, every Israeli, when I told this story, I told this story 100 times at my lectures in Israel, that Peres lost the elections of 97 because he was blackmailed. And by the way, I met Eli Yishai not at party headquarters. I met him in his office. He was Minister of Social Affairs. I was in the cabinet minister's office when all this took place. So what's going on is that it's election night now. And what happened is that the television polls give the election to Peres. They give him a 2.2% margin of victory, and all of Israel that supported Peres, of course, were in seventh heaven, and they waited for him to come to the party, which was at Yad Eliyahu, but Peres refused to come. He wouldn't come, even though he was declared by every news media, the television stations, as the winner. He would not show up. But a very odd thing happened. The loser, Netanyahu, did show up at his very unhappy, disheartened convention in Beit Ha'am in Jerusalem, and he showed up smiling. It was about midnight, and he says in Hebrew, Lolido, he says, don't worry, we have till morning, I promise you I'll be prime minister. And no one knew what the hell he was talking about. He had lost. All the polls had him losing. And then at 2 in the morning, everything changed. All of a sudden, Peres didn't have any more votes. Netanyahu just went through a string of votes, and he won by 34,000 votes. Less than, 34,000 out of a couple million votes is not very many. In that election, there was a record 144,000 spoiled votes. Now, to give you an idea of how much that is in a little election where you've got a couple million people tops voting, probably less, there was a deliberate campaign in the 2000 election to spoil votes, which I joined. I threw in a spoiled vote. I wouldn't vote anymore. And a lot of people joined me. Altogether, 62,000 people spoil their votes. 144,000 is absolutely impossible. The Israeli people are not such imbeciles as to spoil 144,000 votes with an election of fewer than 2 million people voting. Oops, I hear the music.
You hear the music. We'll be right back in just a moment. Our guest is Barry Shamish. And of course, we're talking about the stealing of elections over there, but don't think they aren't stolen here. Do you remember, of course, in the year 2000, Gore won Florida, and that would have given him the presidency, and then, of course, they came up with the hanging chads, and then the Supreme Court intervened and had no right to and declared George Bush the victor. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Barry Shamish. You go right ahead and pick the story up there, Barry.
Well, I knew I had the story right. I knew who I met. I met Yitzhak Sudri, spokesman for Shas. I know I met Yaakov Moore, the financial director for Elie Ishai. I met this very honest PhD student in law. There were 144,000 spoiled votes. And incidentally, there are 5.5 million Jews. A lot of them are children. It's about 10% of the votes were spoiled. So just to give you an idea, if you've got 1.5 million voters or 1.7 million, it's 8%, 10%. Unheard of. Absolutely unheard of. But I still couldn't prove the story until I spoke in Beit Shemesh in the year 2000. Now, that was a very weird day. My car was tampered with. I almost crashed it. It was the first attempt on my life, and I gave the speech anyways. I actually hitchhiked to the speech and left the car abandoned in a parking lot so I could give my speech. And it was a very big crowd. It was just in a home, but there were 100 people there. And at the end, a person stood up and said, "I want you to know something. I was a poll supervisor in the 97 elections. I had an entire polling station that I was the supervisor for." And he points to everyone and he says, "We burnt Perez's votes. We took them outside and we burnt them. We got instructions to collect the votes. Anyone that was for Perez, we burnt it and we replaced them with nothing votes, with blank votes." And I took them aside. The name of the person, by the way, for verification, which is something that I always do, is David Morris. He was the one who organized the lecture. I finally found a person in charge of a polling station who admitted that he burnt Perez's votes on instructions. Now, this is complicated, how it was done. You don't need to know how it was done. This is Israeli politics. But nonetheless, Benjamin Netanyahu won the 97 elections by blackmailing Shimon Peres. And now we return to the murder of Khaled Mashal.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Barry Samish as we explore more and more of this and begin to bring this back up to the world of what's going on. All right, fine. Well, Barry simply was covering the fact that there was no question at all, and he was able to verify the fact that the election in 1997 in Israel was rigged because at a speaking engagement, the man who arranged it with 100 people there stood up and said, "I headed one of the polling booths. We were ordered to take all the votes for Perez outside and burn them and replace them with damaged ballots." And, of course, that's why there were 144 damaged ballots that were not counted, and of course most of those were votes for Perez. Perez lost the election, and Netanyahu won the election, and Perez certainly understood what had happened, but I don't think he certainly wanted all the information to come out that he was responsible for the murder of Prime Minister Rabin. So pick the story up.
Well, Perez, this is a rare case where he's successfully blackmailed, but that is not the end of Perez. The man despised Netanyahu for, he would have been legitimately prime minister. He won the elections. And by the way, lest you think that Israel has a grand democracy, that's how it works. The elections are rigged. Or at least that one was certainly rigged. And I have proof of other elections, all kinds of rigging. Nonetheless, you know, I'm going to give one example. Just one silly example. I believe it was the 90s, whatever election they divided the party from the prime minister, you voted separately. I voted for the most obscure party, the Green Party, something that had no chance whatsoever as a protest. And when the election polls were published in the paper, I looked in my city, Modi'in, and I looked for my one vote for this party, and it said zero. And that means that vote, one way or another, was not counted. And And I assumed that they, you know, they might have actually had enough seat, enough votes to actually get a seat, and they were taken care of. These are not democracies. They're not honestly run. Now, I'm not going to talk about America. That's your problem. The Israeli election of 97 put in the loser, Netanyahu. And now we have the attempted murder of Khaled Mashal, again, who Jimmy Carter is flying to Damascus to meet, head of the Hamas, the party of Hamas. He's the head. Well, in 1998, Peres got his revenge. He exposed to the Jordanians that there was a Mossad squad in Amman, and it was going to try and kill Mashal. The Jordanian police arrived in time, to save Mashal from whatever injection was given to him. Within 24 hours, Netanyahu had the Mossad send over the antidote, and the Mossad hit squad was returned to Israel. There, that's the story. I hope it made sense.
As a matter of fact, it did, and so now this is the same gentleman who's over living in Damascus. Jimmy Carter's going to go to visit him to negotiate peace. And, of course, you know, you can't negotiate peace with Hamas because Hamas is intent upon the destruction of Israel. And so why, certainly, are we giving money at many times to PLO, and PLO then gives money and weapons to Hamas? I mean, basically, we're training the PLO, we're training the followers of Abbas, who certainly are going to fight with Hamas against the Jews. We are creating the best enemy money could buy, and now an ex-American president is going to go to Damascus to meet with the leader of Hamas. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yeah, that's the appraisal. I mean, even if he wasn't going there to meet with Mashal, what's he doing to go to Damascus? Since when can Americans get a passport to go to Damascus? There are a lot of questions about the sanity of Carter. But don't forget, he wrote a book saying that Israel was an apartheid state like South Africa was. He's no friend of Israel. That's putting it kindly. Now, let's look at some of the results. This week has been as the usual busy week. We find out from the Israeli newspaper Kol Hazman, and it got put by Aaron Klein over the World Net Daily, that yes, Israel has been conducting negotiations over Jerusalem. Tzipi Livni, foreign minister, and my lord, what have they got on her? I still haven't found. She's negotiating with Abu Ala, and they have come to an agreement that Israel will give the PLO, or the Palestinian Authority, like there's a difference, Jerusalem Airport. Now, let me tell you what a disaster giving the PLO Jerusalem Airport is. And I'm not talking about Israeli planes what it's doing, reducing Israel to one international airport. This airport was shut down for security reasons a few years ago. What it's doing is giving the PLO an airport over Jerusalem. And who knows, an airplane landing in Jerusalem doesn't have to land at that airport. It can land anywhere it wants to land. They, theoretically now, could actually use it as an Air Force base. Okay, this is a big airport. You don't give your worst enemy an airport in your capital city. You can't possibly say it any other way. This, defensively, from the point of view of security, is an insane act. And apparently it's an act that has taken place this week in Jerusalem. Were you aware of this?
Yes, I was, and I think I agree with it. It's an insane act. It would be sort of like giving Osama bin Laden a small airport just outside of Washington, D.C.
Same idea.
Okay, go ahead.
I have many problems with the whole 9/11 story to begin with.
Well, so do I.
From your point of view, I imagine it's exactly the same thing. Now, next, you've got an issue where Condoleezza Rice was in Israel a couple of weeks ago, and she let it out. She said that her policy from here on in is that we will, I have a quote here, we will hold back military resupply of Israel until it needs the weaponry. Who is she to decide when Israel needs the weaponry? This policy, I have not seen anyone anywhere make a fuss about. That's what they did in the 73 war when Kissinger withheld military resupply until Israel was on its knees. This is bad enough coming from Rice, and impeach this woman if you possibly can. But here's what followed the Rice visit. Now, the most shocking thing, the Israeli army emptied the armories of Yesha, of Judea and Samaria. There were these armories of weapons in case of war where the army couldn't get to a settlement under siege. There were supplies of weaponry to keep the settlements alive until the army could bail them out. They're called pre-supply armories. The army emptied them. They emptied the Yesha of its wartime armory.
And that what you're basically saying is what they have done is disarmed the settlers in Samaria there, and basically then they'll have no means of protecting themselves when they come under attack.
Short of going into their homes and frisking them and taking away their guns, this is as bad as it gets. They're disarmed.
Right.
All right. Now, what did the army say? Why? Now, here is the insanity of Israel. You need an excuse for doing such a thing. And remember, these are probably really lousy arms. If I know Israel's rifles that haven't been fired, RPGs that are past due date by 10 years. I mean, the armies of Israel are not taken care of. The army is suffering dismal apathy, but nonetheless, here's what the army said. They are emptying the armories because they're worried. Here's the quote. There have been break-ins. That's it. The Arabs have broken in to the armories, and therefore we're going to fool them by taking the weapons out.
No, we're going to fool them by disarming the Israeli settlers is what.
That's what we're going to do.
Right.
We're not going to put better security in. Why should we put in better security? It's so much easier to just clear them out.
Well, why should we take the gas masks away from the Israeli citizens when there's a very real danger of a chemical or biological attack? And we're not talking about sometime in the future. We're talking about in the next few months. Why would you do something like that? Unless, of course, you wanted, of course, an awful lot of Israelis to die. Why would the government do that to their own people? Well, maybe, of course, they don't look upon them as their people. Maybe they have a different agenda, a different worldview. Go ahead.
Well, there's a new strategy in Israel. In case of a chemical attack, you hold your breath for 5 years.
Of course, they said it may take 5 years before they can get the gas mask back, so I guess that's a pretty good strategy.
Yeah, that's all that they're left. Just keep holding your breath, people, and nothing will hurt you. Now, what the Yesha Council security head said was that why would the Arabs break into our lousy armories when the Americans are giving them brand new weapons? They have more weapons than they know what to do with. Why would they even break into our armories? They don't want our lousy weapons. And by the way, that's truthful. That's a truthful analysis. Yesha this week, in case of war, is essentially disarmed. But there's more. There's more in the wake of Rice. Rice ordered Olmert. You don't even say requested. There's no concept of requesting Olmert to do anything. She orders him, and he obeys, and then gives an obsequious press conference with no shortage of hyperboles for Bush or Rice as the best friends Israel ever had. She ordered over to remove 50 roadblocks in the West Bank.
Now, because those were set up to keep terrorist bombings from coming into Israel, wasn't that right? Terrorist
bombings. These 50 roadblocks are essentially the dirt roads. They're not the main roads. They're the dirt roads that you can sneak into Israel through these dirt roads. They're now unguarded. They're unguarded right now. Rice essentially said, we're not going to resupply Israel with any military hardware until Israel needs it, which in her mind will be never. She ordered the removal of 50 roadblocks, and she ordered the army to disarm the settlers. This happened all of the last week to 10 days. All of this happened. And no one's reporting that. I can't believe that no one is reporting this.
Well, I can believe it. I believe, of course, Israel is being left open to be defeated. And, of course, the people in Washington, D.C. are really a part of this movement that hates Israel. But, of course, they're not going to come out and say that publicly. But they want to see Israel destroyed.
Oh, and now I'm just going to do a how much time do we have?
We got about 5 minutes.
All right, I'll do it quickly then. Number one, there was a terrible terrorist attack at a gas station on the Gaza border, Nakalos it was called, where two Jewish truck drivers were not just killed. The terrorists came in and sprayed them with bullets, threw grenades at them. Their bodies were like butchered meat. And the key is, the gas station was run by Dor Alon Energy. Dor Alon Energy had a major fire in Texas. They have an operation in America. I believe it was a refinery that burnt to the ground a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And a lot of people, I don't know how many, but in my circle of people, there were a lot of suspicions that it was a terrorist attack. Just note that the Nakal Oz fuel station was also this very same Dor Alon company. And we're not going to go into what are these gas and nuts cutting off the fuel that supposedly they need to drive their cars. That's what the fuel station was. That was the fuel station for Gaza. But we know that they try and create humanitarian crises, thinking it's to their advantage. But next, they are now sniper firing at Israeli political figures, and it's now getting serious. This week, Major General Yoav Gallant was touring just outside Gaza when. By the way, people from Canada, I believe the Foreign Minister of Canada was amongst his guests. They were under sniper fire. They had to dash for cover. It was very, very close to the Gazans killing an Israeli major general. But the head of the Shabak, Avi Dichter, has been targeted twice. And in the first incident, a rocket blew up his neighbor's house. He got lucky. It missed his house by a few feet and blew up his neighbor's house. The second incident, again, 3 weeks, a month ago, was at Sapir College. Dichter was again targeted and rockets again. And his aide was moderately wounded. He could have been killed. It was very, very close. Dichter has been, the head of the Shabak, I add, has been targeted twice in the last month and a half or so. And finally, Olmert visited Ashkelon recently, and the rockets started aiming at Olmert while he was there. They're trying to knock out high Israeli government figures, and they have come very, very close to doing so. Finally, in my last minute or so, the 60-year anniversary.
Barry, before you do that, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website and how they can get your books. And we'll give you 3 minutes here after. Tell us how to get your books, how to get to your website.
Right after the music.
Good. No, right now.
Oh, my books. Go to lulu.com, www.lulu.com. Write my name, Chamish, in the box that says search. Write Chamish. You'll get to my books. My website, barrychamish.com, will do it. If you want, I have a wonderful new DVD called Taking Back Israel, and none of my DVDs are on Lulu. So if you phone me at 904-501-7605, that's 904-501-7605, very reasonably priced, 7 different DVDs.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, Barry, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
It's amazing. You phone me today late. We got major headaches trying to get a house and mortgages, and I just looked at this week's file. It's ridiculous how bad things are on one crummy week. The 60-year anniversary, Israel's 60th anniversary, is as good as dead. There was a public petition. So far, 90,000 have signed it not to spend on this anniversary. The morale of the country is too low to celebrate. People are too disillusioned with the state and with their government. They don't want to celebrate Israel's 60th anniversary, a very major anniversary by any standards. It's going to go away without even a peep because the Israeli public just don't feel like celebrating anymore. They've actually run out of morale.
And, of course, I think there's been a conscious, organized, orchestrated effort on the part of the leaders of Israel to create this feeling of dissemination, discouragement, and almost despair on the part of the Israeli people. And they've done a pretty good job of it.
They've done a marvelous job of it. They got rid of people like me. They killed other people. I spoke about Adir Zeke. One of these days I may speak more about him. The fact of the matter is the crooks don't want to be exposed. The people don't want to believe they're run by crooks, but deep in their hearts, they know they're run by crooks because they don't want to spend for their 60th anniversary, an anniversary which, by the way, Israel has stayed alive for 60 years against incredible odds, and nobody wants to celebrate it.
Well, I'm sure there must be some people over there who certainly would refuse to sign that, you know, because this would be almost like a feeling of repudiation of Israel and for the Israelis. Many of them have given a good part of their lives, and many of them have fought for it in the past. It must be a very discouraging time, but, of course, they don't have a spokesman out there saying, hey, what we need, of course, is to replace our leaders, get people who believe in Israel and want it to survive, of course, for our children and our grandchildren.
Watch out. Netanyahu, leader of the opposition, will be the next prime minister. And just remember, over the Rabin assassination, he blackmailed Shimon Peres and won the 97 elections. He's just as crooked. He's not as crooked as Peres. He's not a murderer, but he's just as morally crooked as anyone else.
But, of course, he's tied into the Council on Foreign Relations. And
deeply.
That is what the Israeli
one of these days, if you want me to do that one again, it's quite a story.
Well, okay, that's another time, another date. But right now, of course, we'll have you again on our other programs, and we'll just talk about what we talked about. Good night. God bless.
Good night, all.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and you know, we have got a lot of problems in America as well. It was certainly about the middle of last month, I think it was about the 18th of March, when there was a great tornado in a place called Greensburg, Kansas, and it pretty well decimated many of the buildings in the town. But there were a lot of people, of course, their houses weren't touched. FEMA came in. FEMA forced everybody out of the town. Now, of course, a lot of people wanted to stay in the town, wanted to stay with their homes and guard them, but, of course, FEMA came in and by force of arms evicted everybody from their homes, sent their agents in, stole money, stole jewelry, took every gun that they could find, and then they dismantled the guns, and when the people finally got them back 3 or 4 weeks later, Why, of course, none of the guns worked. They were all dismantled. Why would they do something like that? Why would they force people to leave their homes so they couldn't guard them? Why would they go in and steal money and jewelry? These are FEMA employees, ladies and gentlemen. But the most important thing is they took all the guns and they dismantled them. And this is pretty very similar to what they did in New Orleans. There was no reason to take the guns away from the people because they needed them to help themselves, to protect themselves against marauders, and yet they wanted to disarm the people. And what you must understand is that there are people in positions of power who have a different worldview. They want a police state. And if you have not yet seen my talk on the planned police state, it's available on DVD. And there, of course, you'll see the Iran-Contra hearings, clips of that, where Congressman Jack Brooks is trying to bring out in the Iran-Contra hearings that there is a plan in 1988, in case of a national emergency, to suspend the Constitution, take away the right of habeas corpus, round up Americans and put them in concentration camps. You hear Senator Inouye interrupting again and again. We can't have that here. We can't talk about that. We can't talk that, about that in public. We'll have private hearings. And then Congressman Henry Gonzalez coming on after the conference saying, yes, the only person who got close to the truth was Congressman Jack Brooks. There really is a plan in case of a national emergency. To suspend the Constitution and round up Americans and put them into concentration camps. And ladies and gentlemen, those concentration camps exist. You need to get our talk and the syllabus on the planned police state. You need to get the DVDs we have on the concentration camps. There's one called America Behind Barbed Wire. Or we have four tape sets on concentration camps. We have material, actually government documents, on the use of civilian internees in concentration camps. We have something called the Concentration Camp Special, which contains everything we've talked about, or you can get them individually, but you need to understand, you need to reach other people and make them understand there are people who have a different worldview. They want to disarm the American people. They want to enslave the American people. And whether they'll use a feigned biological attack using some of those biological warfare agents that the CIA and the military have cooked up. You have to understand the military is collecting dossiers on you. And if you doubt that, why you certainly need to get the material we offer. And you can go up on the Internet and find that the military has been collecting dossiers on American citizens in violation of the law. So is the FBI. So are other government agencies. Why are they doing that? Well, we're supposed to be in a war against terrorism. Ladies and gentlemen, who was it, of course, who came to America to attack us on September 11th? Why, it was 15 people from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the largest financier of terrorism in the world, and we're doing everything we can to back them, keep them in power. And, of course, the second largest financier of terrorism is Pakistan, who we are funding with billions of dollars every year. And none of this makes sense unless you understand is what we've done over and over again, created the best enemy money could buy. You really need, of course, to get my material entitled Foreknowledge 911. It's a 3-pamphlet set. And then, of course, you want to get our pamphlet, The True Story of 911, material you won't be able to get elsewhere. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And again, the pamphlets, Foreknowledge 911, 3-pamphlet set, The True Story of 911. Of course, that's a single pamphlet. And then, of course, Pray for America, Pray for Revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But, of course, in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or the supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Howard Nemeroff, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Gun Control Fear of Facts. That's Gun Control, Fear of Facts. It's actually a pre-publication copy that I have enjoyed reading it this evening. There's a great deal of interesting information that I don't think anybody has really presented at all, going into the background of this effort to take away the guns of the American people. And, of course, as Howard really points out in the book, there have been instances in the history of America where there's been efforts to take the guns away from people. Of course, they didn't want the Indians to have weapons. They didn't want the blacks to have weapons. They didn't want the Japanese to have weapons. It was all right for other people to have weapons, but there were certain selected groups, and what would happen if one day they said, well, we don't want Christians to have weapons? The people who have the weapons have the power. Those who do not have the weapons have no power. That's why our founding fathers wanted every citizen to be able to have weapons to protect themselves against excesses by the leaders of our government, and yet that's never taught in schools today. Howard, you at one time were in favor of gun control. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself, and then we'll get into your fascinating manuscript.
Okay. I'd moved out to California about 22 years ago now, from Minnesota. And while I was there, I got involved in a massage, and so I went to school to get my massage certification, moved out of the corporate world where I had been a software engineer. During my sojourn in California, I definitely was exposed, especially being in Marin County in the massage school, was exposed to a lot of new age thinking, and thought it was really wonderful at the time. And one of the things was about being peaceful and, you know, peace, and if you're peaceful, other people are peaceful. So I started believing that if I was in favor of civilian disarmament, that would make a more civil society. And then, of course, later in my research, I found there's a lot of people who believe that. I also found in my research that that's not quite true. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. One of my clients, actually, who's a police officer, and he also was ex-Special Forces, Green Beret, came in to see me for an injury he got on the job, and started talking to me about some things. And at first, I didn't really, you know, think too much of what he was saying, and I kind of wanted to argue against him, but I really didn't know enough to rebut what he was saying. So I thought, well, you know, when I was in college, I really loved doing research. So I thought, well, why don't I take out those research chops and dust them off and go do my own research and see if he's saying that what he's saying is true or not true. So I did, and what I found was surprising and even a little disconcerting. So I began my journey to become a supporter of gun rights as opposed to civilian disarmament.
And, of course, this is a really very important issue because, of course, there really are people who want to disarm us, and they're not interested about presenting crimes. They're not interested in accidental deaths or suicides. They really want to take the guns away because they want to control the population. Now, this isn't the majority of the people, but it is the people at the top, the people who are financing it. The people with the power want ever more power over our lives. Well, Howard, you picked the story up there.
Okay. Well, the beginning, that's the beginning of the beginning, you could say. I started with, like you were alluding to, I started looking at some history and found that, well, this is a serious problem, because the only instance I could find where gun control was successful, at least from the point of view of those in power, was to disarm and have control over other groups, beginning with the early colonists, what they did with the Indians, passing gun control laws so that the Indians could not own working firearms, they could not own ammunition. And we all know what happened to the Native Americans beginning in the Northeast. And then we went and I looked at pre-Civil War laws where blacks, free blacks, were banned from owning firearms, even up to the point where some state Supreme Courts were ruling that blacks really aren't full human beings, so therefore it was okay to ban firearms from them because firearms are only for citizens. And then we went to World War II. Time and time again, I saw the same thing. And like you say, only those in power benefit. I became very concerned that, being a person who supported civilian disarmament, I actually was a useful fool, because I was going to support them doing something that I didn't understand the consequences of. And, of course, by the time they accomplished what they set out to accomplish, it would be too late.
Well, I think you really, of course, you really did a great job. You brought out a lot of things that I hadn't read about before, I hadn't heard discussed, and believe me, we've done a lot of programs on gun control, so I thought that you had some very, very fresh ideas here. And, of course, one of the most significant things is the fact that in both Australia and in Canada and in Great Britain, they've legislated very, very restrictive gun control laws, with the idea that if we could take the guns away, why, we would do away with gun crime. And, of course, since by taking the guns away from law-abiding citizens, why, this is then going to allow the people to live in peace and harmony, and there will be no violence. And yet, as Howard goes ahead and analyzes the statistics out of Australia, the statistics out of Great Britain, after they passed their gun laws, why, you find a marked increase in every instance in the instance of gun-related crimes. And we'll be back in just a moment, and I'll let him develop those ideas. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were talking about how Howard, in his manuscript, and it's a very fascinating manuscript, I'm looking forward to it coming out as a book, because I think it's something we'll certainly want to carry. But he analyzes what happened in Australia and Great Britain when they passed legislation that simply took, for all intents and purposes, all right to gun control away from the people, with the idea that if we remove the guns, we'll do away with gun crimes, we'll do away with suicide. But that's not really what they found. That's not what happened, is it?
Well, and this is where I started looking at the comparative theories between the pro-gun proponents and the gun control proponents. And one of the things that the pro-gun proponents were saying is that civilian disarmament harms those who are the most disadvantaged by being disarmed. In other words, elderly, women, people of smaller stature. Now, one of the things I found in my study of Australia and Britain is that before their gun bans were enacted, their rates of rape and sexual assault were about the same as the United States. Okay, by 2005, which was about 8 years after the gun bans in Britain and Australia, British women were now raped and sexually assaulted nearly twice as often as women in the United States, and Australian women were raped and sexually assaulted nearly three times as often than women in the United States. So there was some very significant data points showing that, yes, when women are constitutionally or legally banned from owning firearms, there does seem to be some sort of correlation. Now, it's hard to prove that the gun ban caused more rape, but it certainly did not help women And that is something that is irrefutable.
Well, I really think it's so vitally important that the people look at these statistics as you've laid them out, and it's not simply crimes against women, but crimes of armed force and, you know, of criminals using weapons. Suddenly the criminals are smart enough not to want to accost somebody who has a gun. If they know that the person doesn't have a gun, then the criminals, of course, are going to be much more likely to either rob and steal and accost people, or suddenly we find definitely that the incidence of violent gun-related crime increases when they take their guns away, because that means the citizens have no protection. Only the outlaws, only the criminals have guns. And this is what people don't understand. Law-abiding citizens having a weapon are not a danger to society. But criminals who have a weapon become much more of a danger to law-abiding society. And what would make anybody in their right mind think that criminals would obey laws? You can take guns away from law-abiding citizens, but do you honestly think the criminals are going to turn in their guns? Do you think the criminals are going to obey the laws just because somebody says it's a crime to have a gun? Of course not. You pick up the story there, Howard.
Sure. This is a good point, because one of the things that the gun control proponents still say is if we get rid of all the guns, then the criminals won't be able to have guns either, because most of the illegal guns start out as legal guns that are stolen and then make their way to the black market where they end up being used in crime. So I would think then that the United Kingdom would be an ideal experiment, because it's a fairly relatively small island kingdom. They should be able to control their borders a little easier than say United States, where we have this long border with Canada and Mexico. So the United Kingdom should be a raging success in gun control, because they banned all civilian ownership. And yet we find that about 8 years, 9 years, 10 years into their ban, gun violence has actually doubled. So it's another one of those truisms that seems to be supported again. You know, the pro-gun proponents often say, well, if you outlaw guns, only outlaws will have guns. Criminals who didn't obey the laws before the United Kingdom banned firearms are still not obeying the laws. And because they participate in an illegal activity called smuggling, they apparently just added another item to their shopping list, and instead of just smuggling drugs, they're smuggling drugs and guns. Same thing with Australia.
We used to see those bumper stickers that said, when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. And so the pro-gun confiscation people came up with a bumper sticker that said, when in-laws are outlaws, then only outlaws will have in-laws. Well, you know, this, of course, was very, very clever. But, of course, it basically was to confuse the issue. And I think it was best laid out in one of the state legislatures when some of the gun control advocates were saying we ought to have these laws. And one of the conservatives said, well, first of all, I'll support your legislation. But first of all, we have to have it stipulate that of course, all the outlaws, all the criminals will turn in their guns. And then a month later, after all the criminals have turned in their guns, then we can ask the law-abiding citizens to turn in their guns, too. And the gun confiscation proponents said, well, that's ridiculous. The outlaws are not going to, the criminals are not going to turn in their guns. And, of course, the conservatives said, that's exactly true. So why do you want to take the guns away from the law-abiding citizens when you know the criminals are not going to obey the laws you pass? And that's the question we should be asking. Why do people want something as illogical as disarming the people, which leaves people open to attack? Every single school in the United States is an open shooting range, because every criminal who wants to go in there and kill people knows that, of course, nobody can have a gun to defend themselves. Why would you leave all the school children in America at risk? And that's exactly what they're doing. The federal legislation aimed at preventing gun violence on school campuses has only served to promote it. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, and if a law-abiding citizen does actually stop a crime using their firearm on a school campus, they are at risk of going to prison for 10 years. even though they may save lives. Now, it was just today that I was reading about another threat. They had to close a couple of colleges in the Illinois, state of Illinois, because they were getting threatening emails saying that, you know, people are going to get it today. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how come police stations never get these kind of emails? How come places where people are armed never get these threatening emails? And most importantly, in the last 6 months, is how come all the mass murders that took place all happened in places where the law said, if you're a law-abiding citizen, you cannot carry a gun here, whether it's a shopping mall in Nebraska or a school. And the only exception was that church in Colorado where a private person there who is on their security staff, it's a congregant, was asked to be part of the security and part of the armed security, and she stopped that shooter before he could really get rolling.
And, of course, the thing is that if we're going to say that guns kill people, and, of course, if we just did away with the guns, why we would do away with violence, we know that police accidentally shoot people all the time. There's three policemen on trial right now in New York City because they pump 50 bullets into an unarmed man. Well, a logical solution would be let's disarm the police and let's disarm the military as well. After all, the military kill people. They use arms that are trained to kill people. So if we took the arms away from the police and we took the arms away from the military, why, we would do away with killing, wouldn't we? Wouldn't that be a logical thing to do? After all, there's some countries where they use the police against the people, where they use the military against the people. Let's disarm the army and the police and everybody and say that's ridiculous. And of course it's ridiculous, but as you pointed out so well in your book, the Supreme Court has held that the police do not have an obligation to protect the citizens of our country. Certainly, there is no place in the law that says the police have to be there to protect you, and if you get killed, certainly because you had no means of protecting yourself, that's your problem. That's why every citizen should have the right to have a weapon in his home to defend his wife and his family. Go right ahead.
This is a very interesting point you bring up because, you know, we just went through the D.C. versus Heller case at the Supreme Court. Now, one of the court cases I cite was from the Washington, D.C. area where three women were raped after they had called the police. Two of the women were upstairs in an apartment upstairs, and they called the police because they thought a woman downstairs was being attacked. Well, the police came by, and that was that, and they didn't see anything, so they kept going. Later, the women thought that, okay, the incident must be over, so they went down to see if the lady was okay, and the attacker was still there. He bound them and raped them. They took this to the higher courts, and again, in this case, D.C. argued that, well, we're under no obligation to provide safety to any particular member of society, and these women called the police, and yes, well, we know that we drove by and we didn't see anything, but we're not responsible. Well, now they turn around and say that we're responsible to provide all the safety, and we don't want law-abiding citizens having functioning firearms because that provides a danger to society. If this is not cake and eat it too, then I don't know what is. And fortunately, that case was pointed out by one of the lawyers for our side. This is found again and again. This is an extremely consistent finding that the police are under no obligation to protect you or me, only to provide protection services to the public at large. So that means that if you're being robbed or raped right now, it's, you know, the police might get there to help you, and they might not. Now, digging up other interesting statistics, I found that in terms of, for instance, justifiable homicide by law enforcement and justifiable homicide by civilians, only about 2%, I believe, of the justifiable homicides by police officers were done stopping a crime in progress. But for civilians, that was about 30%. So in other words, the civilians were available and on hand to stop a crime in progress a lot more often than the law enforcement, if you're using justifiable homicide data as an indicator.
Now, what were those statistics again?
They come out every year. The FBI comes out with two tables where they tabulate the justifiable homicides for one table for civilians, one table for law enforcement. And it is available on the Internet at the FBI website.
But, of course, what are the general statistics? What's the relationship between justifiable homicide for police officers and justifiable homicide for civilians?
The relationship?
I mean, what are the statistics? Do you have them at your fingertips?
Yeah, I'm looking them up right now. Justifiable homicide by weapon. Okay, here's through 2004. Let's see. For instance, in 2004, there were 437 justifiable homicides by police officers and 229 by private citizens.
Okay, fine. So
I said you can find the more recent one. I know that's gone up.
All right. Well, of course, certainly you point out, of course, that the motor vehicles kill an awful lot more people than guns do, and yet nobody's saying we ought to take away motor vehicles because, of course, they have the potential to kill people.
Well, yeah, and drunk drivers kill more people each year than criminals use firearms to kill people. But I haven't found any of the organizations that are using the children or deaths to convince us that we need more gun control. I don't see any of them going to bat and saying, well, we need to do something about automobiles and drunk drivers. In one chapter where I look at Consumer Federation of America, they're trying to use the idea that guns are an unsafe, unregulated product to convince us that guns need to be more regulated. And, of course, their regulation would result in a political appointee in Washington being able to effectively ban the purchase of any firearm they so choose. And that's kind of a scary thought. But using the same criteria, the Consumer Federation isn't willing to say, well, we should use the same criteria on drunk drivers. Like maybe we need to have devices which are like breathalyzers so that you have to breathe into it before the car will start. They don't do anything like that. So I really, that's the other thing I found disconcerting in my conversion to a gun rights proponent is that these people apply a criteria to guns, but they are unwilling to apply that criteria to anything else. So it's a real double standard.
And, of course, far more people die from automotive accidents as a result of automotive accidents than, of course, die because of gun crimes or because of the use of guns. What about the use
of guns? Automobiles are, which, Consumer Federation in this case says automobiles are highly regulated and there's a mechanism for recall. But I noticed that the recall and all the regulation
Hold that thought right there, Howard.
Hundreds of thousands of deaths.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess.
Is being Howard, released Howard, onto the streets every year.
Howard, hold on there, because we just bringing back all of our stations on board. Our guest is Howard Nemeroff, and we're talking about the relationship between the use of automobiles and death. And, of course, automobiles certainly create far more deaths than guns do in the United States, and yet nobody suggests we should take guns away, automobiles away from the people, to cut down on the number of deaths. So they play on our emotions, and as Howard points out, they talk about the children. Oh, we're so concerned about the children, but a lot more children die of preventable diseases or preventable conditions than die of gunshot wounds. But, of course, they play on our sympathy because they have an agenda, and that is they want to disarm the American people. So go ahead, pick the story up there, Howard.
Well, the children, that's another gambit. for instance, Senator Boxer, your wonderful California senators, has claimed that 8 children are killed daily by firearms. And this came out in 2004 when she gave this talk. Now, I, of course, decided to look that up and see what was happening, and I found that if I included people up to about age 23, 24, you'd get about 8 people being killed a day. But actually, if you use what is considered to be a child, in other words, under 15, prepubescent, according to the definitions that I found, it's less than 1 child per day who's being killed. And, of course, almost all of those are due to criminal violence. And the thing that I would like to introduce for thought there is that since a child, by nature, is much smaller than an adult, why do you think if an adult was intent on killing the child, they would need a firearm? It just happens to be handy, but anything would, even their bare hands would be usable. So, again, this emotional appeal is not to protect children, but it's to promote gun confiscation.
In fact, you know, the thing is, if you really want to protect children, I think every home should have guns. They should be used intelligently. Children should be told, you know, they're to avoid those guns, but those guns are there to protect them. And, of course, in families where there's no protection at all, many times children are killed and raped and terrible things are done to them because, of course, they have all these regulations, especially here in California. Every gun has to be in a lockbox. Well, if a thief's going to get into your house, what good is a gun in a lockbox? You've got to have a gun where you can get your hands on it and, of course, where you can fend off the intruder. But they don't want that. They don't want you to be able to defend yourself. Step by step, whether it be registration of ammunition or taking away ammunition or insisting that you have all your guns locked up so you can't get to them, all of this is aimed at eventually making it totally futile for people to be able to have weapons and to defend themselves and their families.
And Washington, D.C. is a prime example of that, where they have a total ban on functioning firearms. It's the first municipality to accomplish this, and they have the highest violent crime rate in the country and the highest murder rate in the country. So, you know, there is a very important data point to show that complete gun bans don't work.
And I think that many times the police there in Washington, D.C., the people who are really on the front lines of this want the people to be armed to protect themselves, so the police will have time to get there before, of course, violence has led to the loss of life. And, of course, I think that the gun grabbers are frightened to death, of course, that the Supreme Court will find out that they will decree that the people of Washington, D.C. have a right to have our firearms, because I suspect that if the people had the right to have firearms, they would act responsibly, and the rate of violence and murder in Washington, D.C. would fall. And that would, to us, do away with one of their major arguments. Oh, my goodness, we want to do away with crime. We want to stop the murder. Well, certainly we know in cities where everybody is to have a weapon, the incidence of crime goes down. We know that in cities where nobody is to have a weapon, the incidence of crime goes up. And basically there was a book by John Lott, I'm sure you're well acquainted with his work, More Guns, Less Crime was the title of the book. More Guns, Less Crime. They don't want you to know that. They want you to fall victim to their emotional appeal. They want you disarmed so they can control you. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Albert Nemiroff, and we're talking about his book, Gun Control, Fear or Fact. And so go right along with some of the other points you brought out, Howard. They're all very, very well and appropriate.
Well, you just brought up an interesting point that I'd be happy to elaborate on a little bit, and that's about the difference between a law-abiding gun owner and a criminal who owns a gun. As one of the types of indicators that would show us about the relative criminality of the law-abiding gun owner, I've been doing data studies of concealed carry licensees. Now, there are a growing number of states that they gather enough data to let me know how many of those concealed carry licensees committed a crime, and in some of the states they even list out the type of crime, whether it was a property crime or a violent crime, what type of violent crime it was. And that kind of data is very helpful because, you know, I know like Violence Policy Center likes to say, well, you know, look at all these licensees in Texas that got arrested. But what they're not wanting you to look at is the fact that during that study period, there were other people in Texas who don't have concealed carry licensees, who are also getting arrested. So I looked at, and now Texas has conviction data, so you can actually see how many concealed carry licensees were convicted of what type of crime, and you can see the non-licensee population older than 21, and how many of those people were convicted of crime. And with using that data, you can then derive a criminality rate. And the FBI usually uses a violent crime rate based on the number of incidents per 100,000 population. So that's my standard. And when I use the data for places like Texas or Michigan or, let's see, where else have I looked lately? Florida. All those places collect enough data to tell me how many of their concealed carry licensees are acting like criminals. So what I find is that the violation rates, especially for the violent crimes and the major property crimes that are tabulated each year by the FBI, we find that the concealed carry licensees are far more law-abiding than the non-licensee population, anywhere from 7 to about 45 times as law-abiding. So in other words...
Hold that thought right there, Howard. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I guess this is Howard Nemiroff, and we're talking about his treatise on guns, and basically it's titled Gun Control, Fear or Fact. Howard, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out at this time?
I'm still working on that, so not at this time.
All right, fine. Well, Howard was just saying that the gun grabbers are always saying, well, look, you've got all these people in Texas who are getting arrested. They've got gun permits, and they're getting arrested. But he's actually compared the number of people with gun control, gun permits, who've been arrested with the number of people who don't have gun permits who've been arrested. So what did you find? Are they pretty comparable?
No. Texas, I'm gonna relate too. Let's look at the Texas concealed carry analysis here. The bottom line in Texas concealed carry is that for every crime committed by a concealed carry licensee, there are about 7.5 crimes committed by the non-licensee population. And it varies from year to year, but that's the average for the years 2002 through 2005. For every FBI violent crime committed by a concealed carry licensee, 8 are committed by the non-licensee population, and that ratio is over 40 for the property crime, for burglary. There's also another part to that, and that's that each crime costs money. Now, a few years back, the Department of Justice did a study, and they tried to assign cost of each of these crimes, a murder, a rape, a robbery, a burglary, etc. And so I looked at the, I did what I called the CHL effect analysis. In other words, if the rest of the population were as law-abiding as the concealed carry population group, then there would be a certain percentage reduction in the number of crimes committed, and therefore there would be a monetary savings in costs, in social costs, work-related costs, productivity, insurance, et cetera, hospitalization. And I found that over the 4 years in this study, if the non-licensee population were as law-abiding as the concealed carry licensees, there would have been nearly a $30 billion savings in crimes not committed. That's billion with a B. Michigan's very interesting because their concealed carry license program is about 5 years old now. And if the, in there, the for every crime committed by a concealed license, carry licensee, there are 75 committed by the non-licensee population. So
what crimes are the gun licensees committing? Are these gun-related crimes?
Occasionally, but not very often.
Okay.
No. This is another another thing, and plus the crimes that are being called gun-related usually are things like the person did not have their license with them when the police asked them. Maybe it was a traffic stop. Unfortunately, it seems like the biggest issue is drinking and driving and having their license with them. This is a big no-no. However, it also is not a violent crime, and in my study, I'm looking at major FBI violent crimes or property crimes, so I didn't tabulate those incidents as have, you know, whether they use their gun or not. However, what I do remember is that rarely do these people use their gun to commit a crime. There is, every year there's one or two murders committed by a licensee. Usually an act of passion. Nevertheless, that ratio is fairly low compared to the rest of the population. Does that answer your question?
It certainly does, and I think it's so important that the states that have allowed concealed carry laws really have actually had a decrease in the violent crimes, haven't they, or have they?
All these states, yes, they have generally seen a decrease. And when I go back to looking at the states in the 1990s and back to 1987 when Florida began this whole movement for concealed carry, the vast majority of these states have seen a dramatic decrease in violent crime. Of course, the overall violent crime in the U.S. has dropped during that time. But what we can say for sure is that in no state has there been a dramatic and rapid increase in crime after enacting the concealed carry law.
All right, fine. So I think that certainly what this does is tend to point to the fact that the people who want to take our weapons away or certainly oppose concealed carry do have a different agenda, because they would lead you to believe that once you have concealed carry, there's going to be all sorts of gun violence at all. And, of course, this is not proven to be true. Would that be a fair statement?
That is a very fair statement. In fact, I was just reading an article about Kansas concealed carry, which has been active for about 15 months now. And I was just reading from their one of their government or law enforcement people, I can't remember exactly where the source was, but they admitted that there hasn't been any outbreaks of violence. The concealed carry licensees have not been doing shootouts over parking lots or traffic fender benders. I saw another quote like that from a law enforcement officer. I think it was Michigan State Police, said the same thing about Michigan's concealed carry law. They haven't seen any kind of rash of violence from licensees. Same thing from the state of Florida, where a number of law enforcement professionals have said the same thing. You just hear it again and again.
And
we thought that there would be blood in the streets, shootouts at the OK Corral, et cetera, et cetera. It never happened. There's 40 states that have enacted shall issue concealed carry laws, where if you're a law-abiding citizen and you pass the training exam and everything you need to do, you can get. They will have to give you a license, assuming that you have no criminal record. In 40 states, it's the same story. There's never been an outbreak of violence. There have not been shootouts because somebody made a funny face at somebody else. It just hasn't happened. Every time they try to pass concealed carry, they come up with the same stuff. Oh, there's going to be violence. Blood will run in the streets. Never happened. It doesn't stop them from using that line again and again, but it never happened.
Well, and I
think law-abiding citizens are just that. They're law-abiding.
Right. I think if you think about Columbine, where, of course, Harris and his friend, Keevil, had gone on the shooting rampage, if there had been somebody in that school with a weapon, why, they could have stopped it. Virginia Tech, when this fellow went in and just started shooting the students. If there had been somebody with a weapon, they could have stopped him. And this has actually happened in other places. Within the last month and a half, there was an attack on an Israeli school in Israel where they had actually, they were teaching the fundamentalist Jewish religion there. And, of course, what was never mentioned at all by the control media in the United States is the way that this was stopped was that somebody there with a weapon and they simply shot the shooter. And this has happened time and again. But the media always plays it down or does not mention the fact that guns save lives. And a gun in the hands of a responsible individual, if there is violence, they can very often either frighten away the shooter or kill the shooter or wound the shooter and stop the massacre. Why does the media conceal that information? Very simply, because there are people who control the media who have a different worldview, and they want to disarm the public. Remember, as we've told you many times before, 90 to 95% of the major media in the United States is controlled by five maker corporations, and they all interlock into what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, Howard, certainly you have a great deal of material in the back of your book. That's FBI statistics, and does that help really to clarify the issues you talk about?
Yes, it does, and that's one thing I really try to pay attention to, is that anything I state is not something I just made up. It's something that I only concluded after I found an overwhelming abundance of research, and I'll have to say that I have not found any data if you take the data set in total, I haven't found any data that supports any gun control idea or proposal as being anywhere near reality. The data I have in the back is all drawn from either neutral government sources or even from sources that might be slightly anti-gun. I purposefully did not cite any data taken off of, say, NRA website or any pro-gun organization's website. I made sure that I took data that nobody could say, oh, you're just a shill for the gun lobby or something like that. It's all there, the tables and the footnotes. Almost all of the material I took off the Internet, I actually tried to save a copy of the web pages so that everything is very well documented, and I won't have to say that there was a flood that destroyed my computer files or a dog ate my homework or something like that.
And you've already got hundreds. You've got probably close to 1,000 references. Do you have any idea how many references are in the book?
Yeah, last time I counted, I think it's close to about 700, between 750 and 800 footnotes or endnotes.
It's really very well footnoted from responsible sources. So the information here is vitally important, and people have to learn how to actually argue on this. I mean, so many people are swept along with the emotional arguments. After all, I mean, who would want children to be harmed by a weapon? Who would want to see anybody needlessly killed with a gun? But if you analyze the arguments that are used, guns save lives, far more lives than they take. And, of course, without a weapon, you have no means of protecting yourself, either from a criminal intruder or from a government intruder who may be there to actually do you harm. And believe me, all one has to do is simply look at the history of the world. And certainly as they disarmed the people in Russia, you know, in 1917, so there could be no opposition to the communists, and then the slaughter began as they disarmed the Armenians, you know, so before the Turkish massacre, as they certainly armed the people in Germany before the Holocaust, as they disarmed the people in China before the great Holocaust that occurred there following the Second World War, as they disarmed the people in Rwanda before they hacked 800,000 Christians to death. The same pattern over and over and over again. I'm sure you probably noticed this way. Of course, first they disarmed the people and then they slaughtered them.
That is a sad but true occurrence. And even just in the year, in the 20th century, there were well over 100 million people killed by their own governments, just as you say, by being disarmed. We'll take care of you, and they did take care of them, except more in the way Tony Soprano takes care of somebody than the way a loving parent would take care of their child. And it's an incredibly sad testament to show that when power gets more and more centralized, it does exactly what was it, Burke, who said absolute power corrupts absolutely?
That was Lord Acton. Burke said, all that's necessary for evil to triumph is a good man do nothing. Acton said, absolute power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
That's it, yeah, you got it. I thought I was a good person when I supported gun control. And I was about to do nothing while something evil happened. And I feel now that I'm kind of like an alcoholic who got sober. I kind of want to help carry the message. I think that you kind of alluded to it before. I think that there's a lot of rhetoric on both sides, and that concerns me. I don't think people really understand, nor do they care, nor are they educated about Constitution and the Bill of Rights in school anymore. And when you start talking to them about, well, the Second Amendment means... It just causes their ears to plug up. What I've attempted to do here is show in real-life terms why the founders enacted the Second Amendment, what it means in practical reality. And if people can understand the practical application of the right of self-defense, then they will understand why the Second Amendment exists and why it says what it says.
Well, how efficient is the criminal justice system?
Not very. I remember I started looking into that, and I found that the first thing I remember is that for every 1,000 rapes that are committed, only about 60 prison sentences are handled out. So that's not really efficient. And especially going back to what I found with the United Kingdom and Australia, where the civilian population was disarmed and the rates of rape went up astronomically.
Wasn't it almost 300%, something like that?
Yeah. It's just, Australia, women are raped three times as often as they are here. So there's that 300%. But I just found that
Well, it was so amazing. Of course, the incidence of gun-related violence, gun-related crimes, was certainly higher in Australia and in Great Britain than it was here in the United States. After they took the guns away, of course, to do away with gun-related violence. So it just hasn't worked. But, of course, the media is not telling you that. The media wants every, of course, American disarmed, and this is the great tragedy. And this is why a book of this sort is really so important, because it has all sorts of very valid statistics. Now, certainly Howard's done a wonderful job of analyzing the statistics that are out there. If we had more time, we could go into it in greater detail. How soon will the book be available, Howard?
We're working on that right now, so I don't know. I don't have a solid date yet.
All right, you hang on there. Well, I guess it has been Howard Nemiroff, and we're talking about his book on guns, and certainly it's information every American needs to know. We'll have him back on when the book is available and you can get it. Well, Howard, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us. Why don't you go ahead and make the points you'd like to?
All I really want people to do is make an informed decision. What I tried to do here is give you the information so you can make that informed decision. If you are somebody who isn't sure about where you stand or isn't quite convinced one way or the other, then this book should help you make a better decision that you'll feel more comfortable with and one that you can support. For those people who are gun rights proponents, what I've tried to do is assemble a handy and comprehensive compendium of all the information you need so that when you talk to your friends and family, coworkers about gun rights, you will be able to communicate to them in a way that will get their attention and get them to change their minds or at least start supporting us a little more. I found this to be true even with my mother-in-law who edited the book. She used to be a professional editor and was adamantly against guns. After reading my book, she changed her mind.
Well, I think any honest person, when they
like to see. So if I can help that process, then I would feel like I've done a good job.
And, of course, the thing is that honest people, when you show them the truth, will recognize it. I know I used to be a liberal. I used to embrace so many foolish things. It took a long time before I could begin to think things through and realize that everything I had learned in my college years, as far as history, as far as social studies, as far as certainly the origin of human life, all of it had been a lie. I was indoctrinated in evolution. I used to argue in favor of evolution. I used to argue in favor of socialized medicine. My goodness, how could I have ever been so foolish? But don't condemn the people who argue on the wrong side, because that is the very essence of what they are, what they believe. You have to have the matters, the facts at your fingertips, and some of the little cliches that we've used here on this program. You need to listen to programs like this over and over again, and I certainly hope that when Howard's book becomes available, you'll want to get it, because he's done an excellent job of compiling the statistics and just showing you what happens in societies when they disarm the public. And, of course, they do not, of course, have less crime. They have more crime of all sorts of violence, of rapes, of armed robbery, and gun-related crimes. Howard, thank you very much for being with us, and I hope maybe we can get you onto some of our other programs. Would you be willing to come on?
Yeah, well, I sure would, and thank you for having me on tonight.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our program with Howard. If you'd like to get a copy of the program, it is available. Of course, we talked during the breaks. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. But I think what you really need to get, of course, is my new talk. It's on the planned police state. And there really are people who want a police state in America. It comes with an excellent syllabus. We hope that you'll get them. And, of course, if you get the syllabus with, of course, the DVD, while you get it at a decreased price. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will certainly want to get my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness, because you can't understand anything going on today unless you understand the spiritual forces behind this so-called liberal mentality, the drive towards world government and socialism and communism. You cannot understand what's going on unless you understand that we've created the best enemy money could buy. So you certainly want to get my talk on the planned police state, and the syllabus goes with that. You'll certainly want to get my little pamphlet. I just started rereading it today. The Communist-Capitalist Alliance, you need to have the material in that. The Communist-Capitalist Alliance. I was pointing out the fact we've financed communism since its inception, just as we are financing the world terrorist movement today by backing the Saudi Arabians who are behind this whole world jihadist movement. And certainly remember, it was 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, so if we were going to attack somebody who is responsible for the terrorist attack, we should have attacked Saudi Arabia. Why did we attack Afghanistan? Well, that was to get Osama bin Laden, but when, of course, he escaped, then why did we continue fighting there? And why are we still fighting there today? And why are we funding the Pakistani government that's funding the Taliban who are killing our boys there in the rice paddy, pardon me, in the, certainly in the poppy fields in the cities of Afghanistan? And it doesn't make sense unless you understand that there are forces at work that want to plunge us into a war with the Muslim world, and I fear that is one of the things that's coming in the not-too-distant future. And, of course, if you want to understand what's going to happen, you have to read the book written by the professor of history at Harvard University, Samuel Huntington. And, of course, it's called The Class of Civilizations. And he will tell you that if we try to force the Muslims to accept our way of life and our democracy and our way of thinking, why, we will, of course, create a terrible enemy. And that's exactly what we've done, and we've done it intentionally. Then you need to get, of course, my talk on the forbidden secret, because there is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years. You need to know what that secret is, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. Let me also suggest the concentration camp special, which you get separately or together. You can get the 4-tape set on concentration camps. You can get the DVD, America Behind Barbed Wire. America Behind Barbed Wire. And the concentration camps are not imaginary. Just as you get our planned police state syllabus, you'll find out that, and to document the fact that they have given KRB, Kellogg, Brown, and Root, some $385 million to stand by to be ready to build concentration camps at any moment. Why would the American people go along with that? Well, because it's the law of the land. The president has passed laws doing away with posse comitatus. He can use not only the American troops, but the Blackwater killers, the hired killers that we have, 100,000 of them or more throughout the world, bring them into the United States to put down any civilian unrest as they begin rounding up American citizens and put them into concentration camps. Learn what's going on and help us to get the information out. Again, our number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our Internet programs 4 hours a day live. Certainly, you can hear our archive programs. You can hear our MP3 programs. You can watch our DVDs. 1-800-544-8927. And remember, the one talk you want to get, Planned Police State, Brotherhood of Darkness, Forbidden Secret. We'll be back tomorrow. May the Lord be with you.